I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Rescue workers in Montcoal, West Virginia, are being held back from getting to the four miners still thought to be trapped in the Massey plant because of a buildup of gases, including the methane that caused the explosion that killed 25. State Governor Joe Manchin said that the process of drilling shafts to release the gas may take up to 12 hours. Meanwhile, some residents are grieving the dead, waiting to hear about possible survivors, and thinking about other long-term safety concerns. Ed Wiley lives in Rock Creek, West Virginia, about 7 miles from the mine. He once worked there on a contract basis. And Ed, we understand your son-in-law was working a double shift just before the accident?
Yes. Normally he's a hoot owl.
A hoot owl?
A hoot owl shift. You have the day shift and the evening shift and then the night shift. They call what they call a hoot owl shift. But we knew yesterday evening that he was fine and at home.
You can't exactly celebrate your good news, I suppose, knowing there's terrible other news for other families.
No, you're just blessed. Family members are not there, and it is a small community. You usually know somebody or some family person that you may know, a friend that has a family member there. So everybody's affected one way or another.
Well, we're seeing quotes from other workers. Michelle McKinney, whose father is known to have died, she says workers took a chance every day on behalf of their employer. What was the thinking about this work?
Well, the guys are proud in such a way. You know, you got to be a brave soul to go underground. The other issue is, you know, it's the only job in town. It's the only way of making any money.
Well, and you have concerns outside of the mine, and they regard the Marsh Fork Elementary School. It sits just beside the plant where the coal is brought to be processed. It's also very close to the dam that holds this toxic lake, all the sludge from the mine. And we know back in 72 there was a terrible accident in West Virginia where the dam broke and this sludge, you know, poured down a river. And you had concerns about how all of this was affecting the health of kids, including your grandchild at the time in the elementary school. What are your concerns about the school?
Well, the school is a very dangerous situation. CNN's on. They're standing in front of Marsh Fork Elementary. They are breathing coal dust. They are breathing toxic chemicals down there as we speak. They're standing directly in front of a dam that has over 240 violations by the federal government. These are the red flags that we talk about. This dam can fail.
Well, you're part of a campaign to get that school moved. You walked from West Virginia to Washington, D.C. to raise awareness about it. You started a campaign called Pennies of Promise to raise money to get the school relocated. It sounds as if that would be something that should be done. What do legislators tell you about why that can't be done?
It's hard to spit out. It's really hard to swallow sometimes. Anytime that you have little children in the path of anything like this, you know, you have a mountaintop removal, 1,800 acres in behind this coal impoundment. You have the coal impoundment. You have the silo issue. You have the prep plant. You know, I've met with Senator Byrd with this. I've met with the governor many a times. And I'm sure they all care about the children. But when you look at the politics of West Virginia, if you look at what side of the mountain you live on, if you're in the southern coal fields, you seem to don't count as much as the other people. Our children count. You know, our people are educated now. We have landlines in here. Our children have computer skills. Our children deserve the same chance as any other child in America. I've been trying for 6 years showing the nation all these red flags behind Marsh Fork Elementary. And, you know, here we are today, got the national press down there, and, you know, I would have concerns if I was the press. You know, and this isn't just about the Marsh Fork kids. This is about all the Appalachia kids. And when you want to look at the big picture of things and environmental issues, this is about all the children.
Well, Ed Wiley, it's a terrible, terrible tragedy there in Marsh Fork. But maybe those images, as you said, of the national press standing in front of this dam holding back this sludge right next to the school will draw attention to your concern. But again, our sympathies for what's happened to your town.
Yes, for all the coal miners, the nation needs to pray for them right now.
Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, switching gears now to a man whose nickname is Peaches, but is said to be the most competitive person on the planet. His stature such that it comes with its own adjective, Petraean. General David Petraeus led the surge in Iraq. Now he's orchestrating President Obama's surge of troops in Afghanistan. But in 2005, he was exiled to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, for running afoul of Donald Rumsfeld's view of how to fight a war. Journalist Mark Bowden profiles General Petraeus in the May issue of Vanity Fair. He says Petraeus spent that time in exile crafting a revolution within the Army. Bowden authored Black Hawk Down, among other books. His piece on Petraeus is titled The Professor of War. And with sectarian violence on the increase in Iraq, we thought it would be a good week or a good time for a profile of Petraeus. Mark, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Robin.
Take us to the beginning of your piece. It's a very different time. He may be embraced by Obama now, but in 2007, General Petraeus had just emerged from that exile. President Bush plucked him out of the chain of command to oversee the Iraq surge because he'd had early successes in Iraq before he ran afoul of Rumsfeld. So now it's 2007, and Petraeus is testifying before Congress about Iraq. Why'd you start there?
Because it was a fascinating sort of low point in the public perception of Petraeus. He had been handed the assignment of Iraq at a time when just about everyone, including people in the Bush administration, had concluded that the war was a disaster. And I think in January of 2007, the best that a lot of people hoped for was that we would withdraw from Iraq as soon as possible and the country would probably dissolve into an awful civil war. Petraeus, took on this assignment in January and changed the whole strategy of the American military occupation there. It took months, during which time things got even more out of hand, or appeared to, because the tactics that Petraeus employed were exposing American troops to greater dangers initially. But by summertime, things had really begun to change. This, of course, was not what was expected by the Democratic presidential candidates who were gearing up to run for the White House. So he appeared before Congress in September almost as like a sacrificial lamb to angry Democrats who had become a majority in Congress and who were kind of gearing up to run on an anti-war platform for the White House. And so he came bearing news of a real turnabout in Iraq that nobody wanted to hear. So I thought that was a good place to start, because here was Petraeus being grilled and in some instances actually maligned by the very people who he works for and with today.
You had Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and as you said, none of them wanted to hear any good news about the war in Iraq. At the time, remember, MoveOn.org had a full-page ad labeling Petraeus General Betray Us. But what does this tell us about General David Petraeus and politics?
Well, I think he is someone who is completely apolitical by design. You know, he's a military man through and through. He was given a mission in Iraq, and that was to try to salvage America's effort there. As you mentioned, his years out at Fort Leavenworth, a total change in American strategy, a rethinking of the way that we fight this war against Islamist extremists. And this was an opportunity for him to put his ideas into practice.
Well, in fact, he'd had a chance when he served in Iraq early on in 2003, 2004. He had one of the only successful contingents there because of his thinking about counterinsurgency and getting troops off bases and in to meet the people. Tell us a little bit more about this Petraeus strategy that he ultimately was able to sort of write up in the new Army manual. What was his thinking?
Well, the basic concept is that in fighting an insurgent or non-state entity like al-Qaeda, the prize is the people in the countries where you're intervening. So in Iraq, for instance, the American policy had been to target the extremists and the insurgents and to employ American forces in such a way that you place them in, and this makes perfect sense, in the least amount of danger. Petraeus saw it differently. He believed that the success in Iraq depended on the support and cooperation of the Iraqi people, who were being terrorized by these insurgents and extremists. So the main goal for him became protecting the Iraqi people and stabilizing Iraq's society, using American soldiers in a much more hazardous way, which was sort of putting them out in the streets instead of behind the huge concrete barriers of bases, and letting the Iraqi people see that American forces were there to protect them. And when he had a chance to apply these principles in his first tour in Iraq, he was the only American general who had any real success.
Well, let me stop you there. He did have success in 2003-2004 with this sort of, thinking of civic rebuilding efforts, telling the truth, trying not to kill or arrest the wrong people, win the hearts and minds. But he ran afoul of Donald Rumsfeld because you need more troops to do that kind of work.
That's right. I mean, Petraeus' strategy essentially embraces the concept of nation building. And President Bush had run for office on a campaign against the whole concept of nation building. And Rumsfeld was the defense secretary who put that principle into practice, which was to try to accomplish your military goals with a limited number of American troops and a very limited length of engagement. And so the problems in Iraq essentially challenged the basic principles of the Bush administration's idea of how to use the American military.
So then he was brought back from exile. He has had a chance to implement that thinking, both in the surge in Iraq, now in Afghanistan. But staying with Iraq for a second, it did work, enlisting enemies, these were the Sunni fighters, to fight with the U.S. against their common enemy, al-Qaeda, from outside of the country. These were members of the Awakening. I'm just wondering, do we know what General Petraeus is saying today when we have members of that Awakening, the Sunnis that battled the insurgents in Iraq on behalf of the U.S., assassinated over the weekend, nearly two dozen shot and their throats slit?
I think one of the things that General Petraeus and General Odierno have labored mightily to do is to explain that the problem in Iraq hasn't vanished. Right now we're going through a period where there's just been an election, so there's a great deal of political uncertainty in Iraq, and I think it is not terribly surprising that the insurgents or agents of discord are stepping up their efforts right now to undermine the chances of Iraq building a successful government right now.
Journalist Mark Bowden, who profiles General David Petraeus in the May issue of Vanity Fair. And Mark, the general visited us in our studios in 2006, and he's not a forbidding figure. He's affable. He doesn't seem to be cut out of granite, but there seems to be steel running through him. Now, you spent a lot of time with General Petraeus. Who is he? Tell us about him.
Well, he is, as his former aide Keith Nightingale put it, the most competitive man on the planet, even though he doesn't look that way. And maybe to some extent because, Petraeus does not present a very imposing or intimidating physical presence, he is overcompensated by pushing himself to extreme limits of physical fitness and demonstrations of his strength and ability to endure. He also, has a, almost world-class lungs. He's one of these runners who can just run even very capable marathoners right into the ground. And so he's used, that physical talent to prove himself physically, because I think his intellectual accomplishments speak for themselves. So I think his men, the men he commands, who make the mistake of thinking that he is a pushover, think twice once he's run them into the ground or defeated them at push-up contests or pull-up contests, things he takes very seriously.
Well, you write that you can see his success all over his uniform, so many medals and ribbons that it could stand up by itself. Childhood friends talk about him being concerned about something he called the whole man score, just wanting to win at everything, every aspect of life. And he, top honors at West Point. He marries the daughter of the commander. Did he really lash his Army Ranger buddy to himself to be the top winner in the Ranger course?
Well, what they do in the Ranger school is they pair you up with another candidate, so you have a buddy. And so you can be extraordinarily talented and fit as Petraeus is, but if you're teamed with someone who can't keep up with you, that poses a whole other element of challenge. So the fellow that he went through Ranger School with, you know, at one point he did say David lashed him to him with a rope, but this was during night navigations when it was so dark that they were afraid they were going to lose touch with one another. But beyond that, he does say that Petraeus basically drove him to complete Ranger School successfully just by pushing him and pushing him, and through his efforts to keep up with Petraeus. You know, Petraeus was the top graduate of Ranger School in all three categories and then was awarded the William Darby Award, which is only given on occasion to truly exceptional graduates of that program. So it's just an early example of how driven Petraeus is to defeat anyone in competition.
But he also, as we've said, was able to think outside the military box. Now, when we spoke to General Petraeus in the spring of 2006, this is when he was at Fort Leavenworth, well before he was named to lead the war effort in Iraq. As we said, this is when he was in exile. And at Leavenworth, he trained soldiers to question military authority. He called them designated skeptics. Let's listen to what he said about that.
They're respectful critics, if you will, very well informed. They actually learn the techniques on how do you, in a sense, analyze plans and operations, and then how do you question those? How do you try to find where the weak points are? How do you probe at the logic?
Mark Bowden, where did he come up with that, you know, question authority?
I think a lot of it comes from his personality, but also his being mentored by General Gavin early in his career. He worked with General Gavin as an aide, and Gavin was a strong advocate of military officers stepping outside the military and going for academic degrees in civilian institutions. So Petraeus earned his master's degree and Ph.D., at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, where he encountered a far broader range of thinkers and opinion than most people who make a career in the military ever encounter. And I think he retained that kind of questioning spirit from those years getting his advanced degrees. And, you know, he's a thinker and he's a doer. And so within the military, he applies that skeptical intellectual approach to everything he does.
What is General Petraeus's blind spot, or are his blind spots?
I don't know of any that I can think of. I mean, I did examine General Petraeus critically, and I actively sought people who would criticize his approach, and I did not find many. I mean, Petraeus's personal style and his intense ambition have certainly bruised egos on his rise in the Army. But he has had such an unparalleled string of successes, and he carries with him such a willingness to question his own thinking that he is universally admired. If I had to try to imagine someone in his role who I would think would be an ideal person, you know, I would have a hard time doing better than David Petraeus.
Well, and so here's some potential criticism. Could you possibly just have fallen under his sway, as many have? You know, we've had many of the young people who are coming up through the military under him. Seth Moulton comes to mind, one of his former aides, who just adore the man. And is it possible that he may be the wrong person, for instance, if there is no way out in Afghanistan and he is so convinced that his way is the right way, he may not be able to see that?
That might be true, but, you know, honestly, Robin, I think if someone from the military is going to step up and say, you know, this isn't working, he is, I think, one of the most likely people to do that.
Mark Bowden's profile of General David Petraeus appears in the May issue of Vanity Fair. You can find a link at our website, hereandnow.org. Mark, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, a little levity, please. A trip to Shroot Farm. Wait a minute, Dwight's bed and breakfast on his family's beet farm only exists on the show The Office, but it's a huge hit on a real-life travel website, as we'll hear tomorrow. Still ahead today, the Pulitzers will soon be announced. We'll look at past winners. That's after the latest news, Here and Now. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown called today for parliamentary elections to be held on May 6th and made this appeal to keep his Labour Party in office.
I'm asking the British people for a clear and straightforward mandate to continue the urgent and hard work of securing the recovery and creating a million skilled jobs over the next 5 years.
Brown took over as Prime Minister after former Labour leader Tony Blair resigned in 2007, and Brown's got his work cut out for him, his country reeling from a $250 billion deficit and a huge unemployment rate after 13 years of Labour rule. Rob Watson is at the BBC's Westminster Bureau in London, and Rob, we're thinking this is sort of a parallel reality to what happened here in the U.S. Here it was, of course, the Republicans, the more conservative party, that oversaw 8 years of financial collapse and two wars. In Britain, it's the left-leaning Labour Party.
You're absolutely right. There is that comparison. And, of course, what's got people, some people in this country and Britain, scratching their heads is, well, how come the Labour Party isn't obviously about to go down in absolute flames in the same way in which the Republican candidate John McCain did while up against Barack Obama in the United States? But somehow the Labour Party and the Prime Minister Gordon Brown are sort of hanging in there by arguing, as you just heard, well, look, the country is about to get out of recession. Do you really want to risk it by voting for the opposition?
Well, and Gordon Brown is portraying the opposition, the Conservative Party known as the Tories, as potentially dangerous and uber-conservative. Their leader, 43-year-old David Cameron, is speaking of a more compassionate conservatism. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, you're absolutely right about the tactics of Gordon Brown and the governing Labour Party, and specifically about Mr. Cameron. The governing Labour Party wants to portray him as being a bit shallow, a bit of a PR man, someone that doesn't really have the age, depth, breadth of experience to be Prime Minister in difficult economic times. Mr. Cameron himself is of a, by British standards, a rather upper-class background. He's very well off, he's very well spoken, and of course he went to a very famous private school in Britain. And so to some extent, the Labour Party has been trying to play the class war card as well as the inexperience against him.
Well, and we understand that the Tories are suggesting raising the national insurance prices. It's just so fascinating. Of course, you have a completely different debate in Britain because you have a national insurance. They're suggesting cutting the number of lawmakers offering tax breaks to married couples. Gordon Brown of the Labour Party said he's going to take to the streets and fight the election in cafes, canteens and front rooms. It sounds almost like an Obama-style campaign. But does he have the charisma? And what does he have to offer as far as policy?
Well, I think Gordon Brown would probably be the first person to admit that he is no Barack Obama on the campaign trail. That is absolutely for sure. You know, there's a very strange thing about the election in Britain. You raised some of those issues about taxes and national insurance. You know, in some ways, none of the major parties here have a real big difference in economic policy. All of them accept that the country's finances are in the biggest hole ever seen in peacetime. So that then becomes a kind of a campaign about the party leaders, their personalities. It's an interesting kind of campaign, and it really is about sort of style and leadership and presentation.
Well, Rob Watson, what do the polls say now about where the Conservative and Labour parties are in this race?
On average, the polls give the opposition Conservative Party something like a sort of 6 or 7 point lead. Well, you think of the lead Barack Obama had over John McCain at the end and what a thumping majority he got, and you start scratching your head and saying, why isn't that happening in Britain? Well, it's to do with the vagaries of our electoral system, we're split into constituencies, and some of them don't reflect all the demographic changes that there have been, and so it's a kinder setup to Labour. So the polls are basically saying that the Conservative Party is in the lead, but perhaps not by enough to win but an outright majority and to avoid the dreaded, as far as they would see it, hung parliament.
And a hung parliament, of course, means neither party has a majority. What happens then?
Well, then it would be up to all the various parties to see which one of them could actually manage to get their legislation through Parliament. So they'd have to try and form proper coalitions or sort of informal coalitions.
All right, well, the race is on. That's the BBC's Rob Watson speaking to us from their Westminster Bureau in London. Rob, thanks so much.
Good being with you, Robin.
Okay, just ahead, the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism. Hint, that's the one that Woodward and Bernstein won. We'll take a look at its storied history in 30 seconds, here and now. Next week, the Pulitzer Prizes will be announced. Excellence for authors, musicians, journalists, from editorial cartoonists to columnists. But the Pulitzer that every newspaper covets is the gold medal, given to a news organization for its public service journalism. Winners include the Washington Post for its coverage of Watergate in 1972 and again in 2008 for its reporting about conditions at the Walter Reed Hospital. In 2002, the New York Times won the gold medal for its Portraits of Grief coverage after 9/11. Smaller papers win, too. Last year's winner was the Las Vegas Sun for its reporting on worker safety. Roy Harris will be watching the Pulitzer announcement this year closely. He's author of the book Pulitzer's Gold, Behind the Prize for Public Service Journalism. He joins us in the studio. And Roy, start by explaining the Public Service Pulitzer a little more, because people might not even connect it with the Watergate Award. So what's it for?
The Public Service Prize was one of the first ones created when Joseph Pulitzer dreamed up this idea in the early 1900s. And the prizes started in 1917. And at the time, there were only three journalism awards. One for reporting, one for editorial writing. Public service was the third prize, and it was the biggest one in his mind. And it has been handed down to us as being the classic prize, but it does go to a newspaper or news organization and not to an individual reporter.
Well, and this is something of a make-good for Joseph Pulitzer in a funny way, because he, for much of his career, was involved in, you know, yellow, sordid journalism.
Not a bad way to save your career, right? I guess, if your name has been sullied by that kind of activity over the years. He was a very serious newspaper man and did a lot of good things, even though he had those years where he took on William Randolph Hearst.
Or actually, he let himself be taken down to William Randolph Hearst's level. And so this was sort of his way of making good. One of the first public service Pulitzers went to the Boston Post. It doesn't exist anymore, in 1921. For its coverage of Charles Ponzi.
Yeah.
The scam was named after him. And you can't review all the public service awards, but just tick off some others.
Sure. Well, the Ponzi scheme, of course, was a great one. I consider it one of the most important awards because it really kind of set the pattern. In the early years, you didn't know what a Pulitzer Prize was. People were still coming out of yellow journalism. They didn't think of newspapers as being particularly meritorious in any way. So it took years into the 20s and 30s before you began to get these great prizes. And there was a newspaper that really brilliantly covered the Little Rock, Arkansas school desegregation, the Arkansas Gazette. It won the Public Service Prize. And then coming down into the years, you had obviously the Pentagon Papers won for the New York Times in 1972. And then the next year, the Washington Post for Watergate.
Well, but you mentioned Little Rock, Arkansas Gazette winning for coverage of school integration. That was in 1958. And it reminds us that sometimes the Pulitzer's gold medal comes with some loss involved, because the Gazette lost readers. Then in 1927, you had Ohio's Canton Daily News. They won for exposing some politically connected local thugs, and the editor was murdered.
It's really true that it comes with loss sometimes, because so much of what goes on into some of these awards is courageous reporting. In Arkansas, awful lot of white readers did not want to see balanced coverage of the desegregation of Central High School. There was a wonderful case in the mid-80s of a newspaper, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, that covered problems with Bell helicopters that were crashing and killing servicemen. And the company, Bell Helicopters, is in Fort Worth. It's the largest employer and barred the newspaper from the facility there for a long time. So, you can lose a lot.
Right. Well, and that brings us to the Boston Globe, which took on two big stories here. I'm thinking of busing in the 70s. It won a Pulitzer for its reporting on busing, but felt that, you know, maybe it did lose a lot of readers because it wasn't perhaps as sensitive to some of the issues of the people who were against busing. And then in 2003, it started digging into what turned out to be the huge Boston Catholic Church sex abuse story. This is fascinating. It's a combination of good gumshoe work, reporters sitting down and talking to abuse victims, but also the reporters at the Boston Globe used something called computer-assisted reporting, CAR. What was that?
Right. Well, it's kind of funny to talk about it now, but back then it was kind of the early years of using computers to do what had been the old note-taking and creation of databases that you just keep in notebooks. but they did an awful lot of that. They also did a lot of that old-fashioned looking through directories. They were trying to find out what had happened to these priests. They suspected that the hierarchy at the church was relocating priests from one place to another to solve the problem, solve in quotes, the problem of a priest abusing youngsters. But the only way they could really track that down was to go through church directories and find out where all these priests went. And it was at that point they did, in fact, begin to use a lot of computer assisting.
Well, putting into these databases the annual reports that were issued by the diocese, you write that they started to see some bland notations, nobody notices them, but then they began to aggregate because, again, they're seeing this now on their computer spreadsheet. And what did they start to see?
Right. Well, it goes hand in hand with the kind of interviewing they were doing. When they would find one case, they would really get involved with talking to the victims. And then they'd combine this with the material they were getting through the computer analyses. And that's where they'd get a sense that, you know, not only did they have the big picture of scores and scores of priests being relocated when there was a complaint about them, but on the other hand, they were getting the intimate story of what was happening in these families. And as you remember, a lot of these victims were coming, 10, 20 years after the offense had occurred. The classic lesson for a reporter is to always be skeptical. The truth is that these reporters and the initial group of reporters on the Spotlight team all happened to be Catholics, and they didn't know it at the time. They did not know that they were all Catholics. They found it out gradually as they began to ask each other about their own experiences with priests.
Real brief, do you have any predictions for this year's winner?
Well, this is not a year where you've got one of those no-brainers. 2 years ago, the Washington Post, in its Walter Reed coverage, it had been covered all over the country that the Army Medical Center in Bethesda had been really mismanaged and was harming the very veterans that we were supposed to be taking care of. But this year, I think you might have kind of a dark horse out there. It might be a small paper. There used to be a group of reporters who would dig into this. They called themselves the Cabal, and they'd try and find out who the finalists were. Unlike the Oscars, the Pulitzers don't announce the finalists until the final awards are listed. So the Pulitzers can kind of surprise you.
Well, Roy Harris Jr. will be one of those waiting to see who does win this year. He's author of the book Pulitzer's Gold, Behind the Prize for Public Service Journalism, just out in paperback. Roy, thanks so much.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks very much.
You know electronica music. Madonna's 1990s epic Ray of Light comes to mind. It became a dance club staple. Trance-like electric beats, human voices bent by technology. But if you've never liked electronica, Wired Magazine's Underwire says there's a new release that could change your mind. That's suddenly one of 12 songs on the new 2-CD set, These Hopeful Machines, from BT, or Brian Wayne Tranzo, as he was called growing up in Rockville, Maryland, where he studied classical music before moving on to the dance floors, first in Europe, then in the U.S., and on to the big screen. Here's a portion of his score for the film Monsters, starring Charlize Theron. And Brian, or BT, joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's really nice to be here.
You said call you BT, otherwise you think you're talking to your mother.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, it's a long-standing nickname since I was a kid.
Well, and now you're like a first-name person like Madonna on the dance floors. How did that happen? Because, as we said, you were trained in classics, started studying piano with the Suzuki Method at 4. You studied at Berklee College of Music here in Boston, the Washington Conservatory down in D.C., Mm-hmm. So how did the switch come?
As a young boy, I was introduced to 12-tone music, aleatoric music, and the switch for me into electronics was probably, I'd say, at about age 10 or 11 when I began to realize that many of the composers that I idolized and studied as a child, were they to be alive today, would be experimenting in the realm of electronics because it represents this infinite sonic toolbox to draw from.
Well, give me an example from these Hopewell machines where we can hear influence of the classic composers in your music. We've got the song Emergency racked up.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I used to make my theater teachers very angry when I was a kid. First, because I would take Chopin etudes and improvise, which is just a big no-no when you're studying classical music. And secondly, the pieces that I wrote, even at a very young age, was fairly dissonant. And so I have this way of writing using a lot of chromatic passing tones. When I write for an orchestra, the melody is built of unavailable tensions. It was the kind of thing that made my theory teachers a little peeved when I was younger. But the end of The Emergency is a good example of the sort of string writing that I do primarily in my film composition work.
Talk a little bit about the technology you use, BT, because let's see, we understand you have a place in the Guinness Book of World Record for the largest number of single edits in a song. This is the composition Somnambulist. Take us through some of this software that you've designed, like the break tweaker or stutter edit. How did these ideas come about?
When I did my last full-length album, which is called This Binary Universe, I had the idea to do these nanorhythmic compositional elements. It's a sort of term I've coined that means anything above traditional notation, so which really, for all intents and purposes, ends at 64th notes. So anything that functions as, you know, duples of that, 128th notes, 256th, 512th, 1024th notes, so on and so forth, and actually applying simple mathematics to these rhythmic figures.
Because a human couldn't possibly play that fast, so you'd have to have software to make it?
That's exactly right. These were ideas that have existed sort of in the ether probably for the better part of 100, 200 years. You know, Elliot Carter experimenting with metric modulation and this idea of, you know, changing meter over time, and John Cage, Stockhausen, these guys have experimented with things involving molecular type rhythms. However, there have not been the tools or ways of achieving these sort of things. So I actually made a piece of software called Break Tweaker. It's over 1,800,000 lines of code. And it allowed me to actualize all of the very kind of, it almost sounds like organized static.
I understand the stutter edit, which is another piece of software, came to you as a kid mowing lawns.
Some of those ideas did come from weed whackers and lawnmowers and tape hopping in a studio in suburban Maryland. And
right. A lawnmower when it's going round and round and round and round. Or I'm thinking of those things you water your lawn with that go tss.
That's an excellent example. Crickets make these sounds. And if you look at the waveforms that crickets make, interestingly, the way that the small clicks that they're making fan out over time typically follows the golden mean. These kind of sounds, we hear them in nature all the time. They fascinate me. And so I wanted to find a way to automate and augment the process of making these kind of sounds. And that, in essence, was the impetus for creating both Break Tweaker and Stutter Edit.
Well, Keyboard Magazine said in 100 years, BT's music could well be studied as the first major electronic work of the new millennium. Pretty heady stuff.
Yeah.
We're listening to Le Nocturne de Lumière.
Yeah, and yes, that's right.
I know that you had, you didn't have to wait 100 years. You had quite a reaction when you played it recently. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was really spectacular. I played this piece after I finished it in Finland, and I mentioned before Elliot Carter, who is very well known for winning the Pulitzer Prize for his his work with what he called metric modulation. And I came up with this idea of interpolating between meters.
Now, what do you mean by that? I mean, when, by meters, do you mean 4/4 time and
yes.
4/8 time? So
what, yes, yeah. Absolutely. So the track is composed in 4/4, which much popular music is, and I wanted to take and interpolate mathematically between the meter of 4/4 and 6/8 over time. And I thought, it sounds so exciting. It's almost like, it feels like the rhythm is sort of falling forward, and then it locks into a new thing.
How do the people react?
Playing this song out for the first time and watching people as this rhythm changed from 4 to 3 was astonishing, honestly. And people, their bodies knew what to do. And it gets me into thinking about genetic memory and this idea of, you know, the origins of rhythm and music, and that, you know, isorhythms are in fact, you know, a part from an anthropological perspective of our memory base. And it excited me a lot watching people immediately lock on to, you know, what is for all intents and purposes a new expression of rhythm.
That's Brian Transo, better known as BT. All those ideas, and they're all in his new double CD. It's called These Hopeful Machines. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. BT, thanks so much.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Robin. Thank you so much for having me.